Support for Access Utah comes from Crum Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches.
Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. In the recently concluded legislative session, several bills addressed the issue of state sovereignty, as the proponents sought. One of those bills, House Bill 148, demands that the federal government transfer to Utah public lands, some 30 million acres of public lands, by the end of 2014. And as Representative Ken Ivory, the House sponsor of that bill, said, if sovereignty means anything, it means not having to say pretty please and mother may I. A lot of frustration with the federal government being expressed here. Also, some state leaders think that they can manage these lands better. Governor Herbert, who signed the bill and supports the bill, says the goal is to optimize economic development, find the right balance of multiple use on public lands, help pay for schools. Opponents say this would be a disaster and that many of these lands would be very, very expensive to manage. Other arguments against, we're going to debate this on the program today. By the way, the grand plan of a coalition of Western states on board received a blow with a recent veto of the Arizona similar legislation by Governor Brewer. We'll talk about that as well. With us in the second half of the program is Representative Ivory, and right now we're joined by Utah-based writer and photographer Stephen Trimble. Mr. Trimble, welcome back to Access Utah.
Thank you, Tom. I'm delighted to be here.
We appreciate you being with us. Stephen Trimble, those of you who don't know, many of you are familiar with his books, is a Utah-based writer and photographer. His most recent books, Bargaining for Eden, The Fight for the Last Open Spaces in America, Lasting Light, 125 Years of Grand Canyon Photography, and there are many other other books. And of course, we talked about many of those here on Access Utah. You had an op-ed piece recently in the Salt Lake Tribune outlining your opposition to this idea. And I wonder if you could, just in brief, tell us the high points of your arguments against House Bill 148 and other bills like it.
Sure, I would be happy to. Well, you know, the underlying idea behind the supporters of these bills is that somehow this was Utah land to begin with. And it never was. You know, this has always been land owned by the people of the United States. And over the years, we've gone through these cycles where people in the West try to assert their sovereignty over what is really federal land, American land, land owned by everyone. And what it really boils down to is a difference in values. It boils down to greed, to be blunt. Is land a commodity? You know, that's one set of values. Is land just another possession to generate income? Or is land inseparable from our roles as thoughtful, ethical beings woven into the web of living things? And if you believe that land is a commodity, then naturally if you're, you know, sort of a states' rights advocate, you're going to insist that land be turned over to the state for development and profit. And if you believe that these are public lands owned by all Americans and a treasure for generations to come, you know, you're going to want to work to conserve those lands. And every couple of decades, Americans in the West insist that these lands belong to the states. You know, we've gone through this over and over again, right back to the homestead era. And I'm sure we'll go through it again. And these bills are clearly unconstitutional. You know, we fought a civil war over states' rights versus federalism, and the Federalists won. And That's where we are today. That's where we've been for a very long time.
Governor Brewer, who is known as a staunch conservative, one of her 3 points that she made in vetoing this legislation was just that. She said she understood the frustration with federal government, but that we live in a federal system.
That's right. And, you know, I don't often agree with Governor Brewer, but she was advancing exactly the same arguments that any good conservationist would advance when she said, you know, this bill is unconstitutional. We have a federal system of government in the United States. you know, these lands do not belong to the states.
Hmm.
And, you know, I think if you go back to the 1800s and look at where these public lands came from, you'll find that they were indeed originally public land. And as each state came into the United States, we began to open up those lands for homesteading. And 214 million acres were claimed as private land under the Homestead Act between 1862 and 1923. And we kept modifying that set of laws as people moved into drier and drier country. And many of those millions of acres reverted to federal ownership when people couldn't prove up on them. And there was just too much speculation, too much aridity. And it was the leftover lands. It was the lands that no one could really make a living from that became the bulk of the public lands, the lands administered by the Bureau of Land Management. And over the course of the 20th century, we began to assert management over those lands as it became clear that they were too dry to farm, too dry to provide a living for most people. You know, there's a direct correlation between aridity and the acreage of public lands in a state. Utah has about two-thirds of the state as public land, and we are the second driest state. Nevada has about 85% public land, and Nevada is the driest state. And that's number one and number two for public land acreage. So that's where we are. You know, we manage these lands. We spend $200 million a year just on Bureau of Land Management and Forest Service land here in Utah. If the state was in charge, we'd have to come up with that money somehow.
So a direct correlation between aridity and the need for these to be managed, or the movement to be managed by the federal government. And I can see that with farming. Maybe you can't farm a lot of these lands. Other uses, can you extract energy from these lands? Could that be a use? If the state took over the lands, there'd be more of that?
Well, we probably would have more of that, but you know, we certainly are extracting plenty of energy from the public lands today. You know, we have, you know, dozens and hundreds and thousands of wells out there on public land. And if we sort of rearrange the portion of that profit that the state gets, that would be one way to address the needs that we're trying to address in this new set of laws. The problem is that people are greedy, and we have to regulate greed. That's really the bottom line. We certainly saw that in the economic meltdown over the last few years. And over the course of the last few decades of the 20th century, we passed some amazing laws, conservation laws, the Clean Air Act, the Wilderness Act, the National Environmental Policy Act. Most of them passed very much bipartisanly, many of them signed by President Richard Nixon. And we really do need to put some constraints on the way that we develop, or we simply turn over all of our land to the development industry. Now, here in Utah, we have a particularly powerful notion that land should be developed. You know, one-third of our legislature has ties to the real estate and development industry, and in past legislatures, the majority of members have come from the development industry. You know, in many years, their biggest campaign contributions come from the Utah Association of Realtors. Our governor is the former president of that association. You know, there's a fundamental difference in values that we would be turning toward if we moved away from seeing these lands as lands that must be managed for the future rather than for the present, and turn them over to, you know, the notion that we can profit quickly, make a killing, and move on. You know, it's Wallace Stegner's old dichotomy between the boomers and the stickers, the people that come through in a boom and profit quickly and move on, versus the places where people make a commitment to the land and live there for generations and generations.
If you just joined us, we're talking about land use. There's a bill recently passed by the legislature, House Bill 148, signed by the governor, which demands that the federal government turn over much of the lands now owned and operated by the federal government to the states. They give the federal government a deadline of December 31st of 2014. And we'll have the House sponsor of that bill, Ken Ivory, in the second half of the program. We're talking with Stephen Trimble, Utah writer, in this part of the program. You're welcome to join the conversation at 1-800-826-1495, 1-800-826-1495, or you can email us at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. So if this were... One of the arguments against this is just tilting at windmills, and costly tilting at windmills at that. But if this were to be enacted, the federal government transfers the land to the states, what's your view of what would happen?
Well, I just talked about that a little bit. You know, it's not going to happen. It just simply won't happen. You know, we have to be reasonable and talk about some alternatives to the frustrations that the people in rural places in Utah feel. You know, it's absolutely true that if you live in a small town in Wayne County or Garfield County, that it's really hard to make a living. And one of the reasons it's really hard to make a living is that it's so dry that it really isn't ever going to provide much of a living for many, many people. There just isn't enough water for agriculture or development or many, many people to live there. So let's look at some alternatives. You know, how do we want to do better at supporting our schools? In a lot of the focus is in the bills that passed is on generating more money for Utah schools. But we have these checkerboards of school trust lands across our public lands. You know, when Utah became a state, the United States government gave the state 4 sections per township to be used as land to generate money to help support our schools. Well, why not block up all the remaining school trust lands that checkerboard our state? And create a massive land exchange that removes state lands from national parks and national forests and wilderness, concentrate those state lands near towns and cities and industrial areas where they can truly benefit children, and then conserve our wildland heritage intact on the great public lands. That's how you grow the economy. You know, in the last 40 years, the fastest growth in the West has been in communities adjacent to protected public lands. So instead of doing everything we can to entice heavy oil and gas development that compromises the incredible heritage and legacy of wildlands and open space that all of us love, instead of spending our citizens' money on this kind of crazy legislative quest, use that money as incentives. Why not, for instance, why not hire Jeremy Rifkin, who is a big picture thinker who advises the European Union and how to facilitate a third industrial revolution, help us convert to a distributed renewable energy economy in Utah. You know, there are lots of very interesting ideas out there that we could apply in visionary ways instead of this sort of backtrack to old arguments that go back decades and centuries. And so I really hope that we can shift the argument. Maybe this set of bills passed by the legislature will actually be helpful in bringing up some new ideas to counter these old ideas.
You said that we have this debate, you know, every few years. One that a lot of us remember, the late 70s, the Sagebrush Rebellion. Is this continuation? This is part and parcel of the same arguments we were having then?
I think it is. You know, back in the 1950s, Bernard DeVoto, a great American writer who grew up in Ogden, was writing for Harper's Magazine and defending the West from the takeover that was being run by the senators from the West in Congress. And then a few days later, Ronald Reagan and James Watt tried in the 1980s, and that's when this term, Sagebrush Rebellion, came up. But by then, we had passed these bills, you know, the Clean Air Act, the Endangered Species Act, and we insisted that business clean up pollution, and we were saving the lives of citizens. So here we are again. You know, we cycle, and it's this cycle of, you know, sovereignty and states' rights versus federalism. It's really very much at the root of the next presidential election as well. And it's natural that the people who live in the West, who feel closest to the land because we have lived here for so long, and because it's such a hard way to make a living, a hard place to live, It's natural that periodically people who have that set of values that sees land as a commodity would insist that these lands belong to the people who happen to live next to them. Now, the people in New Jersey disagree. The people in Ohio disagree. The international visitors who come by the millions to enjoy these places that are so unlike any other place in the world, they disagree as well. You know, the outdoor recreation industry that comes to Utah twice a year for its national convention because of our public lands would disagree. And so do you think that those millions of international tourists are going to come to southern Utah every year if they think that undeveloped land and dark night skies are just big problems that we need to solve? You know, those are attractions, and they grow our economy. And that's where the future lies. And I think that the more we can think about that together and have a conversation with each other about interesting and visionary ways to continue to live in these dry places, that's where we need to go.
Let's go to our first caller, Margaret in Vernal. Margaret, welcome to the program.
Oh, good morning. I want to agree very much with the gentleman that's speaking. Vernal suffered greatly for lack of visitors when the monument was shut down for repairs. And also, the other thing I wanted to add was the Nine Mile Canyon, which has some remarkable rock art and things like that, that they've now got a road or building a road to go through it for the oil industry, I understand. And that's going to ruin those things.
You know, I'm really glad that you brought up Nine Mile Canyon, Margaret, because there are a couple of examples of doing things right out in the Uinta Basin where the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance has struck a deal with two different energy corporations. And one of those is on the fringes of Nine Mile Canyon, and the other one is along the White River. And in both cases, the energy corporations absolutely knew that they would end up in court if they simply drilled willy-nilly and paid no regard to various potential wildlands. But instead, they sat down at the table with the conservation community, represented by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, and figured out how they could drill in a way that did not harm and impact the remaining wildlands in that gorgeous country in the Uinta Basin. And it was totally a win-win situation. And through that conversation, before we got in the courts and started screaming at each other, we reached a compromise that allowed for common sense energy development and also did not do any damage to that land.
You've said that this is a clash of values, right? Fundamental clash of values. And so now you brought up a hopeful scenario where we had an actual compromise. Do you think more of those are likely, possible?
Well, I sure hope so, Tom. Some interesting ideas come from Dan Kemis, who's the former mayor of Missoula, and who writes in very interesting ways about the future of the West. He's imagined the creation of gigantic land trusts that would turn whole watersheds over to local compacts of states and Indian tribes and citizens. And the big difference between that suggestion and what the legislature has proposed is that he insists on two basic agreements, two assumptions, that the lands remain public in perpetuity and that the trustees of those big land trusts manage them for ecological sustainability. You know, an approach like that has real possibilities, but it's embracing far more stakeholders than this current grab for power by the politicians here in Utah. You know, there's an assumption that I believe wholeheartedly about these kinds of conversations that we have about our land. It's always better to have too many people at the table than too few. You know, you've got to give people a voice. And that's what SUA, the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, was able to do with those energy corporations. Both sides felt they had a voice. Both sides felt listened to. And they were able to come to an agreement. And I think it's that conversation that's so crucial. You know, you really should have Representative Ivory and me on at the same time so we can talk with each other. And that would be even better. You know, we tend to kind of stand up on our soapboxes and preach. And that's really pretty much what this legislation is all about. You know, imagine if the legislature had come come out through, say, Envision Utah, and asked us to create those kinds of ideas, big land thrusts, addressing whole watersheds to make better management on the land that would benefit everyone. What a wonderful thing that would be.
Mm-hmm. Of course, there are many people who are very satisfied with the federal government's management. These things come in cycles. What's your prediction here? This will just fade away, and we'll have another one of these in another 20 years?
I'm afraid that is the prediction I would make. The biggest employer in a lot of rural places in the West is the federal government and state government and county governments. You know, we need to take care of each other. We need to take care of the land together. The national forests in Utah go back to the early decades of the 20th century when the citizens of Utah pleaded with the federal government to establish national forests and manage the land and deal with the millions of sheep that had eaten the range down to the bone. You know, we really can't rely on just our own small state budget to manage 30 million acres of land. We can't even support our own state parks with the budget we've got. And so, absolutely, I think that this is going to go away. It's clear that no other state is supporting us. Similar bills didn't even make it out of committee in Colorado. And the bills that passed in Arizona were vetoed by their very conservative governor, who acted with a great deal more common sense than ours. And I think it's just going to go away. I actually had the chance to stand up at a public conference and ask Secretary of the Interior Ken Salazar what he would recommend to those of us in Utah who did not think that these bills were a great idea. What was his advice to us? And he really just sort of rolled his eyes and said, "Don't worry about it. These bills will die. They're going nowhere. They're unconstitutional."
Finally, just about out of time, but I wonder if I could have you just articulate. I know you've been very eloquent in your books about these lands as restorers to the soul, that sort of idea. This is really what people on your side are fighting for, aren't you?
Yeah, and we're fighting for everyone. We're not just fighting for, you know, the urban pilgrims who go to those wild places and enjoy them. I really think that the public lands of Utah are much more valuable to our spirits than they are to our pocketbooks. And I think that if we could all get out there and stomp along the riverbank together or take a river trip together or take a walk together, people from all sides of the political spectrum would agree with that. We live in an absolutely remarkable place, and we have an extraordinary opportunity for access on foot, on horseback, driving the back roads, seeing the country in the Colorado Plateau, the Red Rock Canyons of southern Utah, the West Desert, the Great Basin Desert, the mountains of northern Utah. You know, these are places that people travel from all over the world to spend 10 days in. And we have the luxury and gift of living right next to those places. And with that comes responsibility. And I think that the responsibility is all about sharing. The responsibility of managing our legacy, both as the people who live in Utah and as Americans who own that land together with all other people in our country. And the more we are conscious of that enormous gift we have of these lands and the enormous opportunity and pleasure we have in enjoying them every day of our lives, the more that leads us toward thinking about, okay, what is the future going to be? You know, we're at the crosshairs of climate change. Things will get even drier. We're losing so many of our wild species as we encroach on their habitats. How do we connect those habitats? How do we keep these refuges healthy? You know, it goes very directly from spiritual refuge to responsibility to imagining a better management to make sure that these places are around for our great-grandchildren.
We've been talking in this part of the program with Utah writer Stephen Trimble. His latest book, Bargaining for Eden, The Fight for the Last Open Spaces in America. Mr. Trimble, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. I was delighted to be here.
And we'll continue this conversation on land use in the next part of the program following a Gina Wickwar commentary with Representative Ken Ivory. That's coming up.
Utah writer Gina Wickwar.
Every once in a while, something happens that truly restores your faith in humankind. Just when I was despairing over the dozens of news articles telling us that our children are getting dumber because all they do is play games on their smartphones, I discovered that all is not lost. There are kids who want to learn, and parents who want to teach them. We were on the plane coming home from a week visiting friends in San Francisco. In the row behind us, a young boy, about 10, was sitting next to his father. They were heading home for New Jersey after they changed planes in Salt Lake. As our plane gathered speed down the runway, the father asked his son to watch the wing flaps and described how they worked to help lift the plane. When we were airborne, he began pointing out the various landmarks rolling beneath us, San Francisco Bay, the glorious span of the Bay Ridge, and further on, the San Pablo River, the Carquinez Straits, Suisun Bay. Soon we were banking to the northeast, and the dad called attention to Sacramento, ahead in the distance. As we approached Tahoe, he continued his geography lesson, pointing out the lake, Donner Pass, and the backside of the Sierras that descended abruptly into the desert floors of Nevada. It was here that the father took up a story about the new gold rush taking place in Nevada, and then he segued into a narrative about Yucca Mountain, nuclear energy, the politics of nuclear waste, and so on. I was listening raptly to all this, fascinated, and so was my husband. This man behind us seemed particularly well-educated, for he said something trenchant about every topic he discussed. Even more significant, he managed to explain his observations to his young son in a thoughtful and totally non-condescending manner. He didn't lecture, rather he allowed the boy to interrupt often to ask questions. A special Socratic dialogue was taking place right behind our backs, and it was wonderful to be the proverbial fly on the wall overhearing it. As we approached the Great Salt Lake, he learned about ancient Lake Bonneville, how the Great Salt Lake was all that remained of it after the Great Bonneville Flood through Red Rock drained most of the lake about 17,000 years ago. He learned why the lake is salty like the Dead Sea, how easy it is to float in, and a myriad of other pertinent facts. Our plane turned southward for a spell before turning to the north for landing. As usual, we encountered some turbulence as we passed northward over Provo and Orem. Amazingly, the father was able to tell his son how the downdrafts from the mountain, this terrain, and the hot air upwelling from the ground collided to cause our bumpy ride. He pointed out Salt Lake City, especially the Capitol building and the temple, and told his son a few salient facts of the LDS religion during our approach, keeping up a steady patter of details about our state as we landed and taxied to the gate. Had I not known he was from the East Coast, I would have sworn he was a native Utah, so accurately did he dispense information to his son. We got out of our seats, and I flashed a quick look at this exceptional pair. They were still talking earnestly about Utah. What was so fascinating about the whole episode, and what gave me renewed faith in our kids' futures, was that, on this whole trip, not once did the young boy ask for his computer, and now, even as we were stopped at the gate, neither he nor his dad reached into their pockets for the dreaded iPhones that are whipped out as soon as a plane bumps the gate. No, these two fellows, father and son, knew the pleasure of learning and conversation. It was heartwarming to see it, let me tell you. This is Gina Wickwar.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Bonnie Plants, plant growers since 1918, dedicated to sharing a love of gardening to help people become a successful and productive vegetable and herb gardeners. Information is at bonnieplants.com.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're talking about states' rights issues, sovereignty issues, land use issues on the program today. Utah House Bill 148, which was passed and signed into law, requires that the United States extinguish title to public lands, transfer title to those lands to the state on or before December 31st, 2014. Other provisions in that bill, the chief sponsor was Ken Ivory, who's a representative from West Jordan, and I believe Mr. Ivory, an attorney?
It's your yes,
profession.
Tom, good morning.
Good morning, and welcome back to the program. Appreciate you taking some time.
Thank you. No, it's good to be with you.
This is, of course, back in the news because of, I'm sure, unfortunately, from your point of view, Governor Brewer's in Arizona's vetoing of the bill. She had several objections to it, although she's known as a staunch conservative. I'm sure this is disappointing to you.
Yes, I mean, of course. I mean, it'd be nice to go through, but Arizona didn't quite follow the same path that we did in Utah. We were able to build the groundswell, and our bill was somewhat substantially different, materially different than the one that they ran through in Arizona. Given the time that they had, I thought it was admirable that they got the bill through the House and the Senate. In Utah, we took an approach where we did work through the access groups, the counties, the farmers, the ranchers, to preserve the 116 years of rights and expectations that have developed on that land from the time of our statehood in 1896. Arizona took a much harder line, and they didn't follow the approach that we did in that respect. And so, you know, from that standpoint, it's somewhat understandable. I talked to Senator Melvin, and he said, "No, we're already working to bring it back, to build the coalitions like we did in Utah with education. We had the teachers' union supporting what we were doing, the PTA, the state school board, the state superintendents association, on down the line, because we've got some real problems, Tom. I mean, I wish there were such a thing as magic wand economics, but I was talking to our fiscal analyst, our legislative fiscal analyst yesterday. He was in a meeting with fiscal analysts from around the nation. Under the Budget Control Act that Congress passed in August of 2011, incident to the debt ceiling fiasco, they said if the super committee couldn't meet its charge, which of course it didn't, beginning January 1, 2013, we begin to face 9% across-the-board cuts. They call it sequestration. Well, Utah has $5 billion of our $13 billion budget that comes from a federal government that's broke. I mean, by any objective measure, it's simply broke. And so that begins in January 1 of 2013 when our fiscal analyst was at this meeting. He said, Utah is the only state at that meeting that is actively preparing, asking the questions, what do we do? How do we go forward so that we can educate our children, so that we can take care of our sick people, our poor people, take care of roads, public safety, basic essential government services, as we undoubtedly face diminishing revenues that come in from federal receipts because they simply don't have it? These are big questions, and so there's no magic wand that's going to solve that. These are things that we're looking at now. With the Arizona situation, yeah, it was unfortunate, but they need to get the bill right, and they need to build the groundswell to be able to go forward. And so they're working on that, and we're working with them and other states getting ready for next year.
Your hope, I believe, is to I don't know if you phrase it, assemble a coalition. You would like many Western states to pass this legislation.
Sure, of course. We're working with folks in Idaho and Colorado. I just got back from New Mexico. Working with people in Nevada, Montana, Wyoming. Let me see if this sounds familiar, Tom. The Western states had finally had enough, and so they got together and they started sending petition after petition, resolution after resolution, delegation after delegation to Congress, and here was their complaint. You're not disposing of our land like you promised. We can't tax the lands to educate our children. We can't grow our economies and provide good-paying jobs for our people so they don't flee the state to places like North Dakota and others. And you're hoarding our minerals and our abundant natural resources. That sound a little bit familiar?
Mm-hmm.
That was in 1828, Tom. In 1828, the self-described Western states of that day were Indiana, Illinois, Missouri, Arkansas, Louisiana, on down to Florida. And their statements were these, and in fact, the Congressional Public Lands Committee, the 20th Congress, the Public Lands Committee, said if these lands are to be withheld, which is the effect of the present system, in vain may the people of these states expect the advantages of well-settled neighborhoods so essential to the education of youth. Those states will be retarded in their endeavors to increase their wealth and comfort because they have not the power, incident to all sovereign states, of taxing the soil to pay for these benefits. When they stipulated not to tax the lands of the United States while sold, it rested upon the implied engagement of Congress to cause them to be sold within a reasonable time. No just equivalent has been given those states for a surrender of an attribute of sovereignty so important to their welfare and to an equal standing with the original states. And so the 1828 Western states knew their history, they knew their rights, they banded together, and they refused to take no for an answer. Consequently, Congress crafted a legislative solution, which is what we're asking for in this legislation by setting the deadline and working forward. And if they don't, we move forward as a state to protect the health, safety, welfare of our people. But their legislative solution worked out that now those 1828 western states have 3 to 4% federally controlled land.
Governor Brewer, one of her objections in her veto was she thought it would not pass constitutional muster. I'm guessing you disagree.
Well, yeah, she obviously isn't aware of this history, because if they succeeded and did this, how is it unconstitutional when it's already been done before? How is it in Article 4, Section 3, Clause 2, where Congress is granted the power to dispose, how do you draw from that the power to forever retain? It doesn't make sense. You've got Supreme Court cases throughout our history developing that say these lands are held in trust by the federal government for the states ultimately to be created. As recently as 1980, the Supreme Court said that these enabling acts are solemn compacts. They're bilateral agreements that the federal government is to perform in a timely fashion. And then, of course, just 3 years ago, this United States Supreme Court unanimously declared that Congress does not have the power to unilaterally change those vested rights of our enabling act to diminish those rights in any way. And they said, particularly where all of our public lands are at stake. And so, you know, these are pronouncements that are very recent on these things. We're simply asking that the federal government honor those same promises, and in many instances, word for word, the same promises that they've already kept with all states east of Colorado to dispose of the lands.
What's your immediate goal, immediate hope? You would like to see this adjudicated in the courts?
No, not at all. I mean, the first hope is that we work together as governing partners that we are. You know, our system is unprecedented in the sense that we have two governing sovereigns in their respective spheres in the state and the national government. Well, more and more, as is the very nature of man and government, one governing power is going to try to usurp more and more authority if they're allowed to do that. Well, the healthy tension that's supposed to exist in our system is that the states curb and check the federal government from getting out of control. That's the very nature of our system. And so what we're merely hoping is that we act as governing partners and work out an orderly governing solution, just as they did with the 1828 western states. That's the hope. That's what we're looking for, number one. Now, some of the comments that we've seen from Secretary Salazar and Director Abbey have been less than encouraging, in the sense of, let's sit down and simply answer the question, why? Why is it that when the Enabling Act terms are word for word identical, you've disposed of all of the land east of Colorado, but not west of Colorado? It makes no sense.
Now, if Congress has to act on this, and they would, I assume, I don't know if this is the right assumption, but no matter which party were in control, they'd be maybe looking out for federal interests. Would they ever act in favor?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, what we're seeing now, Tom, we've got a $16 trillion national debt. We're overspending by more than $1.5 trillion a year, and the unfunded obligations, the promises already made for which we don't have money, for Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, by CBO estimates, exceed $60 trillion. This is serious. I mean, we've never been here in the history of the world before, and yet just week before last, the Government Accountability Office, testifying to Congress, said there are more recoverable oil reserves in Utah, Colorado, and Wyoming than the rest of the world combined. We have the answers. I mean, we've got right here the opportunity to unleash full employment throughout the United States, to grow our economy in such a way that we actually can reduce deficits and debts and get that under control, and bring back a semblance of fiscal responsibility on a long-term basis, on a national basis. This isn't just a Western problem. This is something we have the opportunity to unleash the economic vibrance for our nation. And, you know, if you think going forward, particularly as members of Congress realize that they got theirs in 1828, you know, the Illinois and the Indianas and the Missouris, when they reconnect that this is their history and not just our problem, we think as we begin this education process that we're hopeful, Tom, that we can work toward a legislative solution. However, the Supreme Court in 2009, in their unanimous decision, they described it as the uniquely sovereign character of a state's admission. Well, think about that for a second. Sovereignty means freedom from outside control. It means autonomy. And it wasn't enough for the Supreme Court to simply say that a state's admission, that they're sovereign in their admission, particularly with respect to their public lands. They said uniquely sovereign. It's kind of like saying miracle isn't enough. You have to say miraculous miracle. That's how the Supreme Court described our rights as in being admitted as a state, particularly with respect to the public lands and the duty of the federal government to dispose of those in a timely fashion. So where people cavalierly throw out and say, oh, this is unconstitutional, well, tell me why. Mm-hmm. Tell me why, when the promise is the same, this is what the Supreme Court has said. Tell me why. That's what I would like to know.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, we're talking with Representative Ken Ivory, a Republican from West Jordan. He's chief sponsor of House Bill 148, which was passed into law, signed by the governor. Among its provisions, it requires the U.S. to transfer title of public lands to the state on or before December 31st, 2014. We're talking about that on this part of the program. In fact, the entire hour in the first part of the program, we talked with Stephen Trimble, Utah writer who's opposed to this, and obviously Mr. Ivory is in support. You're welcome to join with your question or comment at 1-800-826-1495. That's the way to get through to this conversation, 1-800-826-1495. Or you can email us at upraccess@gmail.com, upraccess@gmail.com. The number again is 1-800-826-1495. You've been talking about the constitutional issues. One argument on the other side is that however much we may lament the way things happened, that over many years these issues have become settled, this is the balance that we've come up with, the federal and state balance, and that it's set. Many people agree with it, and you're just kind of tilting at windmills here.
Well, you don't waive sovereignty. That's something that is not, you don't lose it, you don't waive it. And again, going back to the Supreme Court, talk about the uniquely sovereign character. And in fact, the federal government has exercised to a limited extent its duty to dispose of the land. It continues to sell land as it's charged to do, albeit at a very, very, very slow rate now. And so they've never stopped in that duty, Tom. It just dragged their feet for 116 years. And what's fascinating, in 1915, our Utah Senate, some of the same people that were around at our statehood involved in the legislature, came up and said, hey, wait a second, you've done a bait and switch on us here. And they said, they sent a resolution and said, we need you in the harmony of the spirit and letter of the original land grants going back to 1780, and in conformity with the terms of our Enabling Act. We call upon the President and Congress for the speedy return to the former liberal national attitude toward the public domain. We call attention to the fact that the burden of state and local government is borne by the taxation of less than one-third of the lands of the state, and we earnestly urge a policy that will afford an opportunity to settle our lands and make use of our resources on terms of equality with the older states and to the benefit and upbuilding of the state and to the strength of the nation. And so what happened was they said, okay, we'll work on it. We'll get around to it. Your land is just a little more difficult. Well, then they got to 1930, and in 1930 they held congressional hearings. And Tom, the title of the congressional hearings in 1930 were granting remaining unreserved public lands to the states. Not if, it was just how. Now, in fact, at that time, the federal government, without authority, proposed that they would grant all of the surface rights to the states and keep the mineral rights. And the states, all of the states, got together and said, no, you're not dividing up our mineral estate. Your duty is to dispose of all of it. And they kept coming back until finally we've absolutely lost connection with our history, to the point of, you know, the statement that you just made, that some people are saying, well, this is just how it is. Well, no, when we have a $2 billion education funding gap, when we have $5 billion at risk from a fiscally suicidal federal government, and yet we've got the largest oil reserves in the entire world sitting right here that aren't under the national park, They're not under the national monuments. They're not under the congressionally designated wilderness areas. They're out in sagebrush territory. Those things under the bill, we've taken the national parks off the table. We've taken the national monuments off the table with the exclusion of the Escalante. We've taken the congressionally designated wilderness off the table by our choice to preserve open space, to preserve access, to preserve these heritage sites. But where we're facing a $7 billion gap in a $13 billion budget, Tom, this is reality. And, you know, unless someone's magic wand is better than mine, we've got to face reality and deal with the abundant resources that we have. Nations have gone to war in history over resources that we have at our disposal to completely control our future, to have the prosperous, thriving future rather than handcuff ourselves and condemn our children to a $2 billion below average education and leave our economic security going forward in a very precarious state. You know, we have a duty to plan and provide going forward.
We do have three calls stacked up, so I appreciate you calling in. And we have about 6 minutes left in the program, so we'll ask everyone to be on the brief side while covering the questions. Let's go first to Jim in Wayne County. Jim, welcome to the program. Go ahead with your question or comment.
Hello?
Yeah, hello. Yes, you're on the air.
Yeah, well, it wasn't so much a question as a comment. The speaker stated that the governor of Arizona wasn't familiar with some of the laws related to this issue, and I think that it's interesting that the speaker doesn't seem to be familiar with the impacts that the oil and gas development in North Dakota have created, and I just don't think that the fragile lands in this part of Utah are able to absorb the employment of the nation to do the same here.
Thanks, Jim, for that question. We'll have Representative Ivory respond.
Again, if we have a magic wand, there's a lot of things we can do, and we simply don't live in a magic wand economy. We've got to deal with real problems that are very tremendous, and yet we've got promises where those resources are supposed to be at our disposal to manage responsibly and wisely.
And I think one of the points was, can those be managed responsibly and wisely? Would there be a nightmare scenario some are seeing with regard to the land in North Dakota?
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about nightmare scenarios, that's pretty hyperbolic. Growth always has its challenges, but you'd much rather have the challenge of growth than have 50% of your budget cut out from under you and have your energy ability completely decimated. Energy is life. Energy is the economy. Energy is how we continue to move forward. And so this is the world we're in. We can either cut that off and reduce our standard of living by 70%, or we provide going forward where we have the ability to be an engine of economic activity and vibrance and life that does fuel education, that does fuel our economy, that does fuel our standard of living going forward.
Let's go to our next caller, Sam in Panguitch. Sam, welcome to the program.
Hello. Hey, sorry I couldn't hear all of the program today because I was traveling through our wonderful public lands in the South. But several comments. I guess first off, the Enabling Act never says that the government, federal government, will get rid of all the land. It just says when the land is dispersed or gotten rid of. And then Ivory is correct that this is all land owned by everyone in America, and what we want to do in Utah is just take it all to ourselves here in Utah.
Yeah, let me respond to that.
Hang on.
Let me take a little bit of time.
Let me respond to that, please. What the Enabling Act says specifically, it says that the federal government will extinguish title. That is word for word the same as the Enabling Act of North Dakota, South Dakota. It's the same in the Enabling Acts of Oklahoma, Missouri, Louisiana.
It does, I don't believe that says extinguished title. But the other point is it also says Utah gives up all claim, all future claim to those lands.
Tom, can we?
Yes, just so let me have you respond to that. All claim, does it? Do you agree with that? It says that.
I'm sorry, Tom.
Representative, the Sam said that the Enabling Act says Utah gave up all claim.
Yeah, and it does. And so if you look, what it says is the people of the state forever disclaim all right and title to the unappropriated public lands until title thereto shall have been extinguished. Now, the Supreme Court dealt with that, and they talk about the history going back from 1780 forward through the Northwest Ordinance. That's the same language that's in the North Dakota Enabling Act, the South Dakota, the Missouri, the Illinois, the Ohio, the Louisiana Enabling Act. What they describe that as is that's a quitclaim. And so what they said, so that the states won't interfere with the federal government in disposing of the land as it's duty-bound to do as a trustee, the states disclaim title so that when the recipient receives title from the federal government, they receive good, clean, clear title. In fact, from the Northwest Ordinance that the Supreme Court repeatedly throughout history has referred to, said that provision is for securing title in the soil to the bona fide purchasers. And yet we put a modernistic read on there and say, oh, there you go, we're supposed to just be a colony. Well, that doesn't make any sense.
Let's go to our last caller. I'll ask each of you to be brief. We only have a couple minutes left. Appreciate you calling in, though. Charles and Logan, go ahead with your question or comment.
I would have more sympathy for the states' rights argument if there were any sign of wisdom in terms of greenhouse gas emissions needing to be on the decline within the next, well, we got to debate. We got to have the debate of how soon it needs to decline, but it does need to decline. It's not whether, it's how soon it needs to decline. That's my comment.
Thanks, Charles.
Well, that's an interesting comment in the debate. The oceans produce more CO2 than any production man has done. So does volcanoes. And so to say that, in that standpoint, we need to do that. If you look at renewables, where people that ascribe to that thought go, if we were to cut out all fossil fuel tomorrow, we would cut off 92% of our standard of living. People would die immediately. Hospitals would cease to run. Even if you go out to 2050, Tom, renewables right now under best-case scenarios might be able to uptake about 30% of our energy needs, which means if we ascribe to that immediately, then we have to cut off 70% of our standard of living. Again, people die. This is our economy. This is how we move forward. Now, that doesn't mean we go out and pollute and ravage. No, we do our best to reduce emissions. One of the things that's fascinating, people like to pick on coal and say, oh, coal is putting out mercury. Coal puts out 0.5% of the mercury into our environment. Volcanoes, sea vents, in fact, even our food puts out 99.5% of the mercury that puts out. But nobody talks about that. They want to demonize our rich source of energy that we have here to be able to fuel the lifestyle that we have. I mean, I guess if we want to go back and live in caves, then we can go there, but that's not our lifestyle.
And Representative, we'll have to leave it there. We are out of time. We appreciate you coming on, talking about House Bill 148 and this effort. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Tom.
And you can continue the conversation on our website, upr.org. Click in the comments to today's story. Thanks for listening to Access Utah.
Access Utah are available. Call us at 1-800-826-1495 or go online to upr.org. This is Utah Public Radio, KUSU-FM and KUSU-FM HD1 91.5 Logan and KUSR and KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan.